Today on the Lazy RPG Talk Show, we're going to look at PJ Coffee's Crafting Heritages and Cultures for 5e. We're going to look at the Kobold Press Campaign Builder Dungeons and Ruins Kickstarter. We have a quick preview of the 13th Age version 2 Kickstarter that's coming out in May. Cynthia Williams, the president of Wizards of the Coast, has left Hasbro. What does that mean for the hobby? And we're going to talk about Matt Coville's video on short form versus long form adventures. We're going to highlight a bunch of short adventures and publishers who focus on short adventures that you can use in your 5e games. And we're going to cover more questions from the April 2024 Patreon Q&A. I'm Mike Shea, your pal from Sly Flourish, here to talk about all things in tabletop role-playing games. This show, like all of the work of Sly Flourish, is brought to you by the patrons of Sly Flourish. Patrons get access to all kinds of awesome exclusive features. The ability to join up with other fellow lazy DMs on the Sly Flourish Discord server, the monthly Q&A, whole bunch of exclusive adventures, a bunch of tools, a bunch of different sources that you get for making your games awesome. To the patrons of Sly Flourish, thank you so much for your support. I had meant to talk about this last week. I thought it was really cool. I picked it up on Mastodon, where I hang out sometimes. And it is the Homebrew and Hacking System Reference Documents. This is made by PJ Coffee. PJ Coffee is on the EN World podcast, which I listen to every week. I really love that podcast. He has developed a lot for Level Up Advanced 5e. And he put together a system for building heritages and cultures out of... So he put together a document about crafting heritages and cultures, sort of designing your own, or even letting your players build their own using a cool point-based system where you kind of pick up different traits. It's a way to make sure that, like, if you open up heritages and cultures wide open, that players don't just min-max things to get the exact right features all the time. Instead, it talks about building and customizing your own heritages and cultures for your 5e games or for your Level Up Advanced 5e games, both, which are kind of compatible. You can kind of figure them out. And it uses a point-based system so that you can pick out different types of features from different cultures that you belong to or different heritages that you belong to and put them together. What caught my interest is that he has released this document under a Creative Commons license so that you can use this document and use the system behind this document in other published works. I think it's really great. I think that here's the Creative Commons license that you can use at the end here. This follows right along the line of the massive amount of material that EN Publishing has put out for Level Up Advanced 5e under a Creative Commons license as well. Why does this matter to GMs? It does matter to GMs in two ways. One is it allows this stuff to be used and that you know it can be used by many different publishers in many different ways. So you know that the system that you're kind of building yourself around or that you're spending time gaining expertise in is going to be around even if the company that's running it decides they don't want to go with it anymore. But also it means that all of the documents are downloadable and you can send them to your players. So one of the things that's often missed when we talk about having documents in Creative Commons licenses is that means you're free to send those documents to your players. That means they can see them. So a lot of times when we look at it and we say, like, oh, well, I would love to play this RPG, but the player's handbook is like $25 in PDF, and I can't expect that every one of my players is going to spend $25 buying it. And I know there's definitely an argument of like, hey, given the amount of joy that we get, $25 isn't that much. But man, sometimes our players are cheap and they don't want to buy this stuff, especially if they don't know how long they're going to play it for. They look at it and want to see it. One cool thing about Level Up Advanced 5e and tools like this is you are free to send them the PDFs completely. Now, it's certainly better if they buy the full book, if they buy the one that has artwork and more story and more flavor to it and everything else. And you should push them to do so if you play it. But if they just want to see what it's like, if they just want to dive in a little bit, being able to send them a PDF for free, legally, that they can download and use on their devices and read and understand, or even use as a reference. Like, they might want to read the book to understand it, but they want to have the PDF around as a reference, is a really handy thing to do. So I applaud PJ Coffee for releasing this under a Creative Commons license. This whole idea of being able to customize your heritages and cultures is really neat. You can find a link to it right off of DriveThruRPG in the show notes to pick that up. So thanks to PJ Coffee for helping to support an awesome RPG community. Kobold Press has a new Kickstarter campaign for the Kobold, the Campaign Builder's Dungeons and Ruins Guide. I think this is the third one they've done. They did one for castles. They did one for towns. I picked up one of, I've picked these up on PDF. I didn't find the ones for castles and towns to be, to grip me too much. I didn't need the level of detail that they included in those books for those locations. But Dungeons and Ruins, I'm always eager to dive into. And this is kind of a two-part Kickstarter. There is the actual book, the Dungeons and Ruins book, but there is also a map folio that includes a bunch of different dungeon maps, 12 different poster size maps for a bunch of different castles, caverns, dwarven halls, barrow tomb, haunted mine, necropolis, ruined hill, temple ruins, temple crypt, trap masters, tunnels, underground bandits, and volcanic lair. I like this because that map folio, if you use these kind of tabletop maps, they're both available on in JPEGs for your various virtual tabletops, but also available as dry erase. And I'm excited to pick that up because it's nice to have these sort of universal maps that you can use in many different campaigns. It's a really handy way. A lot of times that the maps that come with adventures are really built for that adventure. These are sort of a general purpose maps. So I think that's pretty cool. There is, they follow the Mike Shea one click preview. So you can get a preview of the kind of stuff that you have in here. A lot of it looks similar to stuff that was in the Dungeon Master's Guide as far as the types of traps, effects, save and DCs, the damage severity by level, but you can get an idea what that looks like. Another interesting thing is that this is both compatible with Tales of the Valiant and Level Up, it should be available to Level Up Advanced 5e, and compatible with Vanilla 5e, and we presume compatible to 2024 revision of 5e. So it's going to be interesting to see these products that are falling right in the line of, we have four different major versions of 5e, 2014 5e, Tales of the Valiant, Level Up Advanced 5e, and the 2024 books. And we're going to see how these things play out. But I think we're pretty safe that these kinds of things are going to be useful and valuable for all of the different systems that we play. Really good looking book, excellent artwork, and who doesn't want more books about dungeons? So take a look at the Campaign Builder Dungeons and Ruins campaign for a Kobold Press and take a look at the preview and see if it's the kind of thing that you're interested in. I did back it. I am excited to get it because I don't think I can ever get enough books or ideas or trends for how to run dungeons. So that is the Dungeons and Ruins Campaign Builder by Kobold Press Kickstarter, which is underway now. Last week, I talked about the 13th Age Bundle of Holding, which I believe is still available. You can still pick up tons and tons of 13th Age books for a very low price that will be compatible with the future version of 13th Age. But they also announced that they have a Kickstarter coming out, and you get a preview document for putting in your email address to be notified when it's coming up. I got the preview document. I also got permission from Rob Hainso to preview the preview document. So you get this preview document, 13th age 13 page preview document that talks about the stuff that is going to be changing, the stuff that they're modifying between 13th age, both what you can expect. This document talks about why you would want to play 13th age, what makes 13th age unique among tabletop role-playing games, and what kind of expectations you can have for the new version, the second edition. The biggest announcement is that it's going to be two books, a player's book and a game master's book. I think that's pretty good. It means that they can add a fair bit of material to it, and you can still have a book that players can pick up, and you still have a book that the GMs can pick up. It was pretty cool. It seems like all the RPGs are going this way. Shadow of the Weird Wizard is a two-book series. Tales of the Valiant is a two-book series. 13th Age is a two-book series. So a lot of these other sort of D20, fantasy D20 games have gone from being a single book. Shadow of the Demon Lord was one book, and the original 13th Age was one book, and now splitting out into two separate books. You get more stuff. Of course, the price tag is a little higher. It was kind of cool having a complete system in one book. I really dug that. I can definitely live with it being in two books, though. And I think it definitely makes sense when you ask your players if they want to pick up a book that they're not buying a book where half of it is stuff they can't even look at. So there's definitely an advantage in that. I can understand it. So signing up with your email address gets you on the alert list so that you will be notified when it comes out. And it also gives you this nice preview document to talk about some of the stuff that they have changed and why you might want to play 13th Age. And it's got lots of really, really cool artwork. Is that an Atiug? That looks like the mother of all Atiugs. That place is nasty. So really neat stuff. Look at that cover. Look at that Game Master's Guide cover. I think that that is very, very cool. I'm very excited for the new 13th Age. I'm excited for so many role-playing games. And 13th Age is one of my favorites. I played it. I played a couple of different campaigns in 13th Age, and I really love it. I like to say, if you are looking for a high-power, high-fantasy RPG with heroic and super-heroic characters that is on a much steeper progression curve than you typically find in 5th edition, 13th Age is the way to go. It is also a very story-focused game with customized backgrounds, icons and relationships, and a lot of other features that build the stories of your characters around the world that's going on there. It is a really, really neat RPG made by two fantastic designers, so I would check that out. So sign up, put your email on the list, and you will get notified. I think the Kickstarter page also has a notify button, but I don't know that you get this preview document when you click the notify button. So if you want the preview document, make sure to give them your email address and pick that up. I mentioned all the cool stuff you get for being a patron of Sly Flourish. One example of just one kind of thing that you get for being a patron of Sly Flourish, and in this case, an adventure toolkit. So when I was about midway through building out the City of Arches, one of the things that I thought would be neat is to build an adventure toolkit. So what is an adventure toolkit? Why is it different than an adventure? The idea here is we have a fixed location, we have a lot of different NPCs, and we have several different situations and several different scenarios in how the characters can get involved. So you as a GM can use this toolkit in order to run a heist, in order to run like an intrigue and roleplay session, or a typical dungeon crawl, and it even gives you the option to give the characters a home base once they complete it. So I put that together into an adventure toolkit called the Secret of Summervine Villa. The idea here is that there is a villa up on the second rise where sort of the hoi polloi live in the City of Arches that's being ruled over by a woman named Lady Elvinia Summervine, who is an elf that is secretly in league with evildoers, particularly with the Cult of the Nameless King. And she runs all kinds of different parties. She connects with all like the counselors of the Golden Order. She, you know, has this sort of front of being a good citizen, but then also secretly she's doing secret stuff in behind the scenes. So the idea behind it is that the characters can sort of get involved. They can either walk right up to the front door and knock and investigate it, or they could be invited to a party, or they could be given a job that they have to make their way in there and find secret stuff. So there's a few different hooks that can go on here. And so you can see we have like the find the key to Arcus goal, the close the gate to Chul goal, and the recover evidence goal. So different goals, but then also different situations. We have a list of the NPCs, the inhabitants who are there, and we have a list of locations, descriptions of who might be in different spots. And we have, where's the map? There's the map. So we have a nice map. This is actually the map that was done by Saga McKenzie. Saga is also going to be doing maps for the upcoming City of Arches sourcebook that I'm going to be crowdfunding, hopefully later this year. And she made this awesome map for the Lazy DM's Companion. We are reusing it here because it's such a fantastic map. I don't know why we would have to make a second one. And we have a one-page map that shows all of the different locations for this thing, including like secret chambers that lead all the way down into a little lair. You could even break into the lair through some other passageway from below, or you could get them from the top. Lots of different ways that the characters could deal with this. We have different situations that could occur, that there could be the summoning of a demon. There could be a party where a bunch of people are getting together, or a time when she is bringing all of the faithful to the Nameless King to her abode. So it is a 5-page scenario. It includes the map. You actually get a VTT compatible version of the map along with the location. And the idea is it gives you enough material that you can build out your own adventures in the details of this one scenario. This is just one of several different kinds of products like this, different sort of adventures and campaign guides and other things, including the full current version of the City of Arches sourcebook that you can get by becoming a patron of Sly Flourish. You can find a link for becoming a patron of Sly Flourish in the show notes. It is very affordable, and it gives you lots and lots of cool stuff, and it helps me put on shows like this. It helps me continue with the work that I do, and it lets you connect to all kinds of other people that are involved in other GMs that are interested in the ways of lazy dungeon mastering. So please check that out. So the big news is that Cynthia Williams, the president of Wizards of the Coast, and left rather abruptly. It was kind of a surprise. So the big question is, does it matter? I argue it does not. It could matter. It probably matters, but none of us will know how. So since not nobody, but almost nobody will know how, only those who are truly inside, and probably 15 years from now, somebody will write a book and it'll be really interesting. But a lot of what goes on behind the scenes at major companies like this is pretty invisible to us. We don't know why she left. We don't know if she was kicked out. We don't know if she walked out on her own accord. And it kind of doesn't matter what happened with that. Now, we also don't really know exactly what influence she had over the hobby. She was only there for 2 years. And so we don't really know what influence she had over the hobby. We also don't know what kind of influence her predecessor will have over the hobby. So we don't know who that is, and we don't really know exactly what they're going to do either. Like, a lot of times there's a lot of like tea leaf reading on, you know, Cynthia Williams said stuff like, we need to better monetize players of D&D, and everybody sort of, you know, their lids popped off, and they're like, oh my God, they're just turning D&D into a corporate enterprise. It's like, they're a publicly traded company. What do you expect them to do? And by the way, Gary Gygax said that 50 years ago. He said one of the biggest problems with D&D is that once you sell them the books, they never need to come to you again. So it's not like that idea is completely out of line. But we all kind of, you know, get connected. There's all kinds of conspiracy theories. But I argue, if it matters, we don't know how. So there's not really a big advantage in us pondering the whole thing. And I still come back to, what's the one major lesson that we can learn from this whole situation? What's something that we can take from Cynthia Williams leaving Wizards of the Coast as president of Wizards of the Coast? The other little bit is, like, being president of Wizards of the Coast feels kind of weird, because I'm sure you're like an executive and you're doing executive stuff, but you're not separate from Hasbro. And she still reports to Chris Cox, the actual CEO of Hasbro. It really feels like a vice president position. Again, what do I care? What do I know and what do I care? But being a president of a subsidiary isn't really like being a president of a company. It's not like she's running the total show and she could do whatever she wants. Chris Cox still has demands and still has things that he wants the company to be able to do. And you're still going to do them if you're the president of Hasbro. So what can we take from it? What can you and I, fellow hobbyists and people who enjoy the hobby that we do? Don't let Hasbro determine your happiness with D&D. Don't let Hasbro determine your happiness with tabletop role-playing games. And the reality is, they kind of don't. Take control of your own grip on the hobby. You get to decide what you want to do with it. You get to decide what you bring to the table. Look at the stuff that you're using and ask yourself, how will the future of D&D, under the direction of an unknown entity, which is the current case, how can you ensure that your own handle on the hobby is resilient from anything that they decide to do? And I have wonderful news for you. You are totally in control of that. You get to decide what products you're going to use. You get to decide if you're going to play D&D or other role-playing games. You get to decide if you're going to focus on the stuff they've already released rather than the stuff they may release in the future. You can take a look at the wide range of different products, compatible products that are being released by so many other companies, and you can decide if you want to bring that. It also doesn't mean, I say stuff like this, don't let Wizards determine your happiness with D&D and have your own grip on the hobby, and people immediately leap to, well, you hate Wizards of the Coast and you hate D&D and you hate Hasbro. I don't hate them. I don't love them either. I don't think you should really love publicly traded companies because they don't love you back necessarily. I think we should appreciate the good products that they put out. We should be critical of the bad products they put out. We can certainly state our desires for the kinds of things we want, but I don't think we should hang on to the fact that they should be the only one to do it. So the one thing I would take from the whole Cynthia Williams leaving Hasbro, leaving Wizards of the Coast as president, is A, we don't have any idea what kind of effect that's going to have on D&D. And instead of worrying about it, what we can do is focus on what our own grip is on the tabletop role-playing game industry and build ourselves a resilient connection to that industry and to the hobby that is indifferent or is mostly indifferent, maybe can only benefit by whatever Wizards of the Coast releases with D&D and can't be harmed by it. And I think that's actually pretty close to the way it is now, that when they put out a product that's bad or that we don't like, and that could be different for me than it could be from you, it doesn't hurt all of the other products we have. And if they put out a product we do like, we get a new good product. So it's almost like having that sort of passive perception baseline that no, you can't go below a certain number. That if they put out new stuff that's good, great. If they put out stuff that isn't good, it doesn't hurt us because we already have all of the stuff that we have and lots of other publishers are putting out material. So hang on to those ideas. If you find yourself, if you're interested in the news of Cynthia Williams leaving Hasbro, leaving Wizards of the Coast. That's fine. Like, I'm interested. Am I worried about it? No. Now, of course, it's different for publishers because we're always constantly worrying about, like, is the bubble going to burst on tabletop role-playing games in D&D? We had 5x growth. Many of us were able to build companies around the growth of 5e. What happens if it dives back down again? But that doesn't matter to the run-of-the-mill GM. That matters to publishers, and that's kind of the, you know, and I can speak as a publisher. That's my problem, not your problem. So instead, worry about, as a GM, worry about your grip on the industry. And make sure it is resilient to whatever happens to Wizards of the Coast, because it can be resilient. Which kind of leads into the second topic that I want to talk about, which was Matt Colville's video on short versus long adventures. I actually think these two topics, or at least my sort of take on these two topics, is actually the same, is actually relatively similar. So Matt Colville had a really good video on YouTube about comparing long form campaigns to short form campaigns. But I did bristle a little bit. I love Matt and I love the stuff that's coming out of MCDM. My friend James Intercasso is a lead designer over there. I love James to death. And I think it is a really good video. I bristle at some of the approaches that it took. I think that it's the premise of this video, I think, is really strong, which is that groups may be better supported by short adventures than long adventures, and that some groups who are trying to run long adventures are end up not going to be served by those long adventures because it turns out it's really hard to keep a campaign going for a long period of time. It's a lot of material to digest. There's lots of reasons why you might say that a long campaign isn't great. What I bristle at is the idea that that is the default. That the way Matt Colville describes it is, well, that's the default adventure. Now, apparently he did do a poll. I don't know the details of the poll, but he said he did a poll of 4,000 people where they said that their kind of default experience with D&D was through long form campaigns. I don't really know what that means. And I don't, you know, given that I'm a guy who also does a lot of polls and has a lot of people come to me and immediately argue the methodology of the poll when they don't like the results, I don't want to do the same thing here. I don't want to be the kind of guy that's just poking someone else's polls. And I don't know the results of his polls. But he did make it sound like the majority of players of 5e are playing and running long campaign adventures. I have run polls myself where that has not been the case. That most GMs, and by most I mean like probably around 50%-ish, right? About, you know, roughly half, I think, run homebrew campaign settings with homebrew adventures. That's what most people are doing. Again, I don't know if it's exactly most, but that's what many of them are doing. So the idea that this is a great big problem, that essentially Wizards of the Coast is releasing long campaign adventures because they are more commercially beneficial, both in manufacturing, but also in marketing, and also in sort of drive and everything else, and that is a real problem, I don't think that's really true. Now, instead, you could say, and this is what I'm going to do today, is here are lots of short form adventures. If you're a GM that finds that it's easier running short form adventures than long form adventures, here's a bunch of different ones that you can try out. I was a little dismayed that the default adventure that he uses as sort of a good example is an adventure that was written in 1981. There are so many publishers, including MCDM, making short form adventures that we don't have to look back 45 years in order to find good examples. There are good examples from publishers that are coming out today. He did talk about Adventure Lookup, which is a place that you can go look up adventures. And I suppose that with the kind of audience he has, if he sort of focuses on any one group of adventures that publishers are putting out there, he's going to have 20 people that tell him about the ones that he missed, or it could cause like a controversy. I luckily don't have an audience that big that I can actually recommend things and not get yelled at for it. But I do think it was kind of a misnomer to say like, oh, woe is us. All we have are large campaign adventures. And can't it be like it was in 1981 when we had these shorter adventures? First of all, those shorter adventures like Temple of Elemental Evil were also really big. The whole Vault of the Drow against the Giants were also really big. Yeah, they were kind of modular. They were sort of connected. You could run one separately from the others, but they were also kind of a series. There was, you know, D1 and D2 and D3 and Q1, right? They were all like a series of campaigns. So the reality is I don't think we have to worry about like what the poor new GM is finding when they go to the store and they never search anything on YouTube and they don't know how to use Google and they get stuck in this, oh, I guess all I can do is run hardback campaign adventures and oh, it's so terrible and now my group broke up. I don't really think it's a problem. Instead, we should just recommend the things that we recommend. And I think saying like, hey, if you're having trouble running long campaigns, and you find that they're petering out, or you find that they're too hard to digest, or you'd rather run some of your own campaign where the characters are the real driver for where the campaign goes, and instead focus on short adventures, there are literally tens of thousands. There are probably hundreds of different publishers who publish material like that. And there are tens of thousands of short adventures that you can choose from. And I'm actually going to pick on some of those today. Merrick Blackman had an excellent article where he talked about this as well. I actually read it right before the show, where he describes the campaign of short published adventures. And he says he kind of a little bit of the same thing of like, you know, is this really a problem? Is this idea that there's large campaign adventures and that that's the default a real problem? Because his point is, A, the DMs Guild has thousands and thousands and thousands of short adventures that you can run. Some of our big hits. I'm actually going to talk about some of the publishers of those adventures today. And also, by the way, Wizards of the Coast does release short adventures as well. They have a bunch of books, and some of them are absolutely fantastic. Radiant Citadel is fantastic. I haven't tried Keys to the Golden Vault, but I haven't heard anything that said it's really bad. Ghost of Saltmarsh is fantastic. Tales of the Yawning Portal is really good. So they publish about as many adventure books that have separate small adventures in them as they do big campaign books. So even Wizards of the Coast can't be accused of only releasing large campaign adventures. So I did find the sort of negative aspect of the video of like, oh, all the GMs are getting crushed by these large adventures and there's a better way, and the better way is short adventures. You can recommend it, but also remember that there are a lot of people who like running long adventures too. They do sell, and Curse of Strahd sells like crazy. He waves Curse of Strahd around as like his example of a bad hardback adventure, and it's one of my favorite adventures of all time. I think Curse of Strahd is fantastic. I think it's an excellent adventure, and I know many, many groups that have run through it and really enjoyed it. So I like, it's fine, and I'm, you know, Matt's going to do what he's going to do, and then I'm not saying my opinion is any more valid than his. My opinion is there's lots of different ways to play this game, and there's lots of different products to support all of those different ways, and I think we can all learn from each other rather than saying this way is the bad way and this way is the good way, and it's really unfortunate that the bad way is the default. I don't think any of those things are true. I don't think that there's a bad way. I don't think there's a good way. There's a way that works for you. There's a way that works for me. There's a way that works for different people, and those ways are different. There are many right ways to enjoy this hobby. There are many right ways, many right systems, many right adventure formats. There isn't one perfect way to run the game. There's your perfect way, which could be different from my perfect way, which could be different from Matt's perfect way, which could be different from everybody else's perfect way. The wonderful thing about this hobby is how open it is, and our ability to kind of pick and choose and select and homebrew and pick up different products of all different kinds and run different RPGs for different situations and really enjoy the hobby in so many different ways. I think it's really fantastic. So check out Merrick Blackman's article on this. It is a really good article that talks about why some of the adventures that Wizards of the Coast are putting out are actually really good as well. I found it to be a good argument about other ways to enjoy the hobby as well. So one other thing I thought when I was thinking about this whole thing, I was thinking about Cynthia Williams's departure from Hasbro, and I was thinking about Matt Colville talking about the defaults for long form versus short form adventures, was Magic players. So Wizards of the Coast has two main product lines, Dungeons and Dragons and Magic the Gathering. And I have a friend who's a professional Magic player. He goes to tournaments. He flies all over the country playing in Magic tournaments. And I talk to him about this kind of stuff. We have lunch every few weeks. And I talked to him about this stuff too, about what it's like as a Magic player. And he kind of hems and haws about Wizards of the Coast as well. Oh yeah, they made these big mistakes, or these things were pretty cool. But I think about what the relationship is of a Magic player to what Wizards of the Coast is doing and what Hasbro is doing compared to a Dungeons and Dragons player. And the reality is Magic players are much more tightly bound to what the whims of Hasbro and the whims of Wizards of the Coast are, because if they want to stay relevant with the current sets, they have to take whatever new sets come out. When the Lord of the Rings Magic the Gathering set came out and it put the One Ring card out there, the One Ring card changed the game. It meant that if you're playing in those particular kind of tournaments where those cards are legal, you now have to account for that. And sometimes the only way to account for that is to have the same cards from the same set. So maybe you can run a deck that doesn't include cards from the latest set. I would expect that most Magic players are not that way. Whatever sets Magic the Gathering comes out with, whatever sets come out from Magic the Gathering from Wizards of the Coast and from Hasbro, you kind of have to deal with whatever those sets are. That's so different than the world of D&D. Imagine, like, think about Magic the Gathering. There's no third-party publisher for Magic cards. It's not like some other, it's not like they've made all of the cards and all of the design of Magic a Creative Commons release thing, and anybody can make cards that are directly compatible with Magic the Gathering. That's pretty much what's happened with Dungeons and Dragons. So on one side, you have an area where there's only one company that's doing anything with Magic. No other company is doing anything with Magic directly. Sure, there's accessories and there's table mats and things like that, but there's nothing that's changing the game itself. So one of the interesting things is like players together come up with new types and new ways to play Magic, including how to play Magic with multiple people instead of just one-on-one, and also to run things like Commander. From my understanding, the entire Commander format was a format designed by players. It was an idea about how they played that then Wizards of the Coast built off of and started to build product lines that support that style of play. I think that thing is pretty good, and that's what's managed to keep Magic popular for 30 years. It's amazing to me. Magic the Gathering, a card game, has been very popular, very profitable for 30 years. That's amazing. But what's really interesting is when we compare that to our relationship with Dungeons & Dragons. Dungeons & Dragons has been around for 50 years, not 30 years, but it has always been a way that players are and GMs are in control of what they're going to run. Homebrewing was part of it for 50 years. Alternate systems, other publishers bringing in material. There, of course, we remember the They Sue Regularly era of TSR, where anybody trying to make a supplement that could connect to it didn't. But since third edition onwards, the publishers of the game have embraced other people building compatible material. And now we have material that's not only directly compatible with it, but also standalone, so that you can have entirely different versions that feel and run exactly like D&D, even different phases of D&D. We have Pathfinder if you really like third edition D&D. We have 13th Age if you really liked 14th, if you really liked 4th edition of D&D. We have four different variants of 5th edition that are going to be available by the end of the year, and all tons of different versions that look at 1st and 2nd and the original D&D, the old BX style D&D. My favorite is Shadowdark. I'm loving running Shadowdark. So we now have other publishers who have said, this is what D&D feels like to me, and here's a standalone book that you can get to run it that way. That's so different than the relationship that Magic the Gathering players have. And I think we should be very grateful for that. Like, I think it's really outstanding that we have that and not lose sight of it, because it's really easy for us to think of Dungeons and Dragons the same way we think about Magic the Gathering, or the same way we think about modern video games, or even like MMOs, where we are 100% dependent on what the company is going to do with a game. There are many games out there now where we are 100% dependent on what the company decides to do with a game. And that is not the case at all with D&D, and it's not the case at all with role-playing games overall. But sometimes we put them in the same thing. We're so used to that model. We're so used to the model of having one central pillar that controls, that's a profit-driven, publicly traded company that's in control of the entire hobby, that we sort of fall into that connection. We start to treat them as though they are the default. We start to talk to people as though they're the default. And they're not. They don't have to be. You get to choose exclusively what your relationship is with this hobby. And it's completely independent from every company out there. Now, again, I love many of the products that are coming out for D&D. I love many of the products put out by Wizards of the Coast. I think the world of many of the designers that they have. I think they're designing a really cool game. I'm very eager to see what the 2024 edition of the rulebooks look like. I'm excited to see what products are coming out. And just as I am excited to see all of the publishers, I am as excited about the 2024 books as I am about 13th Age version 2, as I am about Shadow of the Weird Wizard, as I am of all of these different systems. They're all fantastic, and I'm really eager to see all of them. That I feel like is a good, healthy relationship for the hobby, because nobody can hurt me, right? If the 2024 books come out and they suck, and I don't think that's the case, I think they'll probably be fine. I think there'll be parts of them that I won't like, and I think there'll be parts that I do, and I think they'll generally be fine. But let's pretend that they were just terrible, and that Wizards of the Coast said, you know what? We're just going to keep evolving 5th edition on D&D Beyond. That's going to be our new default platform, and we're going to put new subclasses and new spells and new feats and new monsters exclusively on D&D Beyond. And you have to have a subscription to D&D Beyond to get them. You have to buy the products there. You can only use them there. We're not going to put them out on any other virtual platform. All of that stuff. And that becomes the way that the relationship is with D&D. I don't care. Because I'm not going to use that stuff. I've got Kobold Press making stuff for Tales of the Valiant. I've got EN World Publishing making stuff for Level Up Advanced 5e. I have plenty of stuff. And guess what? I can make all my own stuff too. I don't need new campaigns. I don't need new subclasses or spells or treasure or monsters. I can build a lot of that stuff, and I certainly have almost more than I could ever use from all of the other companies that are producing it and will produce it in the future. So I think we're really in a good spot. Now, so the argument comes up like, well, that's great for you, Mike, but what about everybody else? You don't have to worry about anybody else but you. It's not your job to make sure that the whole, that D&D succeeds and that Wizards of the Coast is going to be good players in the community. You're not responsible for that. You can be responsible to be a good steward of the hobby. This is something I'm going to talk about more. What does it mean to be a good steward of the hobby? The diversity of our hobby is one of the things that we should be talking about. If you're talking to other players, and it doesn't mean swearing them off of D&D. Our job is not to get people away from D&D. Our job, well, not our job, I accept this job. You can decide for yourself what you want to do with it. I'm not the boss of you. You get to decide. But I don't feel like it's beneficial to tell people who got excited about the hobby through D&D to stop loving D&D. I think what's cool is to show them the things and embrace the fact that they love D&D, and then also show them other stuff. Hey, yeah, I've been using these books, these monsters from Kobold Press, and I really like them. Or that works really well, but some of the problems that you've been facing as a GM in D&D, actually books that were published by EN World are really good too. If you're looking for better monsters than the one that are in the 2014 version, you can actually get better monsters from Level Up Advanced 5e, and it's really excellent. And they have online tools where you can look them up, and they have a system resource document that you can download for free if you just want to check out the monster stats. But also the book is really good too. There's so many different publishers. I think opening the eyes of newer GMs to the wide range of other systems and other supplements for their existing system without tearing down the love that they already have for the game is a really good way to be, one good way to be a good steward of the hobby. And I think we can do that and not feel like we have to worry about what Wizards of the Coast is going to do with D&D. Savage Double K says, hell, you can completely remove hammers from your game and be wildly successful. It turns out, I don't know if anybody knows this, so Shadow Dark, the role-playing game, had a multi-million dollar Kickstarter and also doesn't have hammers in the equipment list, and that tells me that if you want to be a successful tabletop role-playing game publisher, you should remove hammers from your game too. Clearly, that's the case. Clearly, I think that science has proven that a lack of hammers in your role-playing game directly relates to the success of your role-playing game. I think that's absolutely, it's just science. It's just pure science. Definitely. Take that one, fellow publishers. Ban hammers. Ban hammers? Let's talk about some excellent short adventure products. If you are a game master who prefers to run short adventures over long adventures, like we heard about in Matt Colville's video on short versus long form adventures, I have wonderful news for you. There are many excellent publishers who are publishing fantastic short adventures that you can use, that you can modify, that you can strip down for parts, or that you can run directly for one-shot games or as side quests in a longer campaign that you build. Today, I'm going to highlight a bunch of different publishers who publish short form adventure material. These are excellent adventures that you can just drop into your campaigns, either as side quests that the characters go on in a longer campaign, or to run as short campaigns on their own, or to run as single session adventures when you have some friends coming over to play your game. My first qualifier for this is to tell you that these are just some of the ones that I've selected. There are many, many others, and I am sure that I am forgetting about and or haven't heard about many other publishers publishing short material. The good news is far more people are publishing short adventures than great big long adventures. So if you are a fan of short adventures, there are tons and tons of them out there. I am just going to highlight a few different publishers today to talk about the kinds of adventures that they publish, which you can pick up for usually very low prices, some of them in print, some of them in PDF that you can drop right into your game. So the first one I'm going to highlight is Arcane Library. Arcane Library makes Shadow Dark. I love Shadow Dark, but Arcane Library also got their start making very simple, very straightforward, easy to digest adventures for 5th edition. Kelsey Dion did this. She got a lot of interest in the products of Arcane Library, and they are excellent, excellent stuff. There's a whole bunch of different collections of adventures that you can pick up, as well as individual adventures that go for $3 adventures. 16-page adventure Adventure, available for $3 on the Arcane Library, but also part of various packages, is Beneath the Black Rose. I've reviewed this adventure on a previous episode, but we're going to take a quick skim so you can see what it's like. If you like Shadow Dark and you like that really brief style of giving you just what you need in order to move the adventure forward, you will very much like these. They have backgrounds. Everything, a lot of it is all in bullet points. So it's just like, bang, bang, here's the information you need. We're not telling you a story. You're not reading a novel. This is material to help you run a game. And I think that's something that the Arcane Library, that Kelsey Dione has done with these adventures, that I think makes them really unique for short form adventures. Word to the GM. These are meant to be run at a glance with minimal preparation and natural delivery. You can see sort of the highlighted phrases that exist. Bullet list, bolded keywords. Each encounter is on one page. Printable cards for monsters and everything. Just really, really excellent design. I love these adventures, and if you're looking for short-form adventures, you can't go wrong. I would pick up some of those packages. You get a pretty good deal on adventure packages for the Arcane Library adventures. But you can see, like, really straightforward, here's an NPC appearance, what they do, what secret do they hold, you know, what do they look like? All very simple, very straightforward stuff, easy to pick up, easy to digest, really good-looking design. The adventure does come with a print-friendly version as well, so if you want to just print it out, you know, double-sided on some paper, you can print it out and won't kill your printer. I actually think this one looks really nice. Like, you know, again, getting that direct style of just give me the facts so I can run my adventure. Works really, really well. So fantastic, well-designed adventures. Arcane Library is really outstanding. If you're looking for short adventures, you can't go wrong. Jeff Stevens, I just pitched a Kickstarter for Jeff Stevens's latest adventure. He's done a bunch of adventures, short adventures on Kickstarter. Those are really excellent. I have written some material for Jeff Stevens for some of his stuff. Adventures from the Potbelly Kobold is an example. The Potbelly Kobold's Guide to Villain and Lairs. And then a bunch of exclusive adventures. The Madhouse of Tasha's Kiss, Happy Jack's Funhouse, Annalise Revenge. Nice, short, easy to run adventure. He also did these encounter books, Encounter in the Savage Frontier, Encounters in the Savage Cities. I wrote a couple of these. Really good short encounter areas that you can drop into your game as well. So getting even smaller than just a specific adventure. Tons of material that are available here, all for a very reasonable price. Some of them published on the DMs Guild, some of them published independently, all available from Jeff Stevens Games. Really outstanding products. Kobold Press, they don't need much of an introduction. I think that they are probably the second, or they're certainly one of the largest publishers of 5th edition material. But they have a whole bunch of different books of lairs. Tome of Beasts, 3 lairs for 5th edition. They've been doing this with each of their monster books. And again, I've written a couple of these. There's a couple different lairs that I've put. I think I did it for the Creature Codex, and I think I did one for the original Tome of Beasts. And they are short adventure lairs. They're definitely more location specific than having like a deep evolved storyline. I actually find that to be very refreshing. I find that it's way easier for me to incorporate an adventure location with a very lightweight story than it is for me to pick up a very heavyweight story. Definitely, Kobold Press also has these sort of more story focused adventures that are not huge. There's a few of them that Kobold Press releases, but I really found the lairs to be easiest for me to grab and run on and throw into my game. There's also Warlock Lairs. That for a while, Kobold Press was running Warlock Magazine as a Patreon feature. They stopped doing that, but they have brought a lot of lairs written, including one of mine, the Temple of Amex Apogean, I think it's called, together in these books of Warlock Lairs that you can also pick up from. So outstanding products, reasonably priced, you know, and easy to drop into your game. They're also published in physical books. So if you're looking for a physical book that you want to have on your shelf instead of just a PDF, they make some excellent, excellent books. Really outstanding stuff. MT Black, my friend MT Black, has a whole bunch of different stuff. MT Black really got his name writing tons and tons of short adventures. I love you, MT Black, but I'm not joining your mailing list right now. I think I'm already on it. I'm definitely on your mailing list. MT Black got his start writing lots of adventures for the DMs Guild, and he really went and published tons and tons of material for the DMs Guild, eventually getting the attention of Wizards of the Coast, who had him write some adventures and some material for them. I think he worked on Descent into Avernus. I think he might have worked on a couple of other things. Now also independently publishes on DriveThruRPG, and he has a whole bunch of different short adventures. Again, some of these he has kickstarted as very small Kickstarter campaigns, ones like the Fraternity of Ash. So they're all available on DriveThruRPG. You can can pick them up. Excellent adventures. He has so much experience writing short form adventures. He's been doing it for, God, like it feels like for the all of fifth edition. So he's like 8 or 9 years, it feels like. And lots of experience writing short adventures. They're very easy to digest, very easy to run, very reasonably priced. Really excellent stuff. So please check out MT Black's short adventures. Raging Swan. I've talked a lot about Raging Swan adventures. Raging Swan makes tons of easy to use material to bring into your pretty much any fantasy role playing game. It focuses on fantasy role playing games, but you can do old school kind of games. You could run it with Shadow Dark. You can run it with 5e. You can really run it for a lot of different things. I did a whole video about Shadowed Keep on the Borderlands, which I think counts as a short adventure. It's a little long for a short adventure, and it's kind of getting bigger into a miniature campaign, but I would argue it's very easy to read, very easy to digest. You can run it in lots of different ways. I love you too, Raging Swan, but I already subscribed to your newsletter. Everybody's got the pop-up newsletter these days. So lots of different material, lots of short material that you can pick up from Raging Swan, lots of prompts to build your own adventures. Really outstanding stuff coming out of Raging Swan, but the one I would definitely recommend, I think Shadowed Keep on the Borderlands is a wonderful adventure. I think it still counts as a short form or short campaign adventure because it's like 1 to 5. So it's not really a huge 1 to 13 adventure. Although I'll tell you, I have expanded it out into a very long campaign, but that campaign has let me build it out in ways that I wanted to build it, which has worked really well for me. Outstanding product from Raging Swan. Now, we would also be remiss if we didn't mention that Wizards of the Coast also publishes really excellent short adventures. The two that I want to highlight are Ghosts of Saltmarsh. Ghosts of Saltmarsh, I ran this as a campaign. I actually joined all the adventures together into a longer campaign. But I think the Ghosts of Saltmarsh book is one of the best books Wizards of the Coast has ever published. It's outstanding. Not only does it have classic old adventures in it that have been rewritten for 5th edition and cleaned up and work well together that you can run independently or you can run together in a series. But it also has some really excellent campaign-specific material for the region around the area of the village. There's a wonderful section that talks about the forest, and reading through the material they have in that forest blew my mind, and it made me rethink the kind of stuff that I produce and the kind of campaigns that I run, because it showed how you can pack essentially a first to 20th level campaign in like 3 pages of text. I have built campaign summaries. I've done this now for Ruins of the Grendelroot. I also am doing it. I'm 3 different ones for City of Arches, based on this idea of like, what would a whole campaign arc look like if you were to run it here? And what material can publishers give to GMs to help them build out their own campaigns based on how that goes? So Ghosts of Saltmarsh is absolutely outstanding and definitely fits in this idea of like how to bring short adventures into a single volume. The other one I'd bring up is Dragon of Icespire Peak. This is available in the D&D Essentials kit. You can get it for $20. On Amazon right now. It is still in print. I would pick it up because I don't know how long it's going to be in print, but I think it's an outstanding box set. And this box set includes Dragon of Icespire Peak is an adventure series, but it's really a bunch of short adventures that are all tied around the city of, or the town of Phandalin. And what's interesting is you can run them all as like a first to sixth level campaign. I did so with my friend Enrique Bertrand. You can find videos of us playing through that whole campaign series. It was a blast. We just played a one-on-one game and it was an absolute blast. But also, each of those little adventures could be run independently. They're all very small. Sometimes they're 2 pages, sometimes they're 4 pages, but that one book contains about 7, 8, or 9 of these different short adventures, some of which you could probably run in just an hour or two. So it's a really outstanding book of short adventures. And I would say that is far more the default than Curse of Strahd is, for example. I would say that the starter set adventures like Lost Mine of Phandelver and Dragon of Icespire Peak are way more popular than most of the large campaign adventures that Wizards of the Coast is publishing. Also, there are tons and tons of other short adventures you can pick up on the DM's Guild. You can look through their 5e adventures. You can look for how they're rated and which ones are popular. There's lots of them, way more than I could cover in this whole show. An example is Baldur's Gate, The Fall of Eltharel, a really wonderful adventure written by Anthony Joyce and Justice Armand. Justice Armand now works for Wizards of the Coast as a designer for Wizards of the Coast. In my opinion, it saved that hardcover adventure. It was a much better introduction to Descent into Avernus than the actual introduction to Descent into Avernus. And it's a short form adventure that you can run in like 1 or 2 sessions. I really loved it. And there's lots of other products like this on the DM scale that you can pick up. Now, of course, who would I be to not mention my own books of short adventures? I have, you can actually pick them all up in one big bundle, as a matter of fact. Sly Flourish's Fantastic Bundle for $40. You can pick up PDFs of Fantastic Lairs, Return of Ruins of the Grendel Root, Fantastic Adventures, and Fantastic Locations. These are all packed with short adventures that you can run independently or in a series of different adventures as part of a larger campaign. Some of them overland, like those found in Fantastic Adventures. Some of them underground, like those found in Ruins of the Grendel Root. And some that kind of focus on big boss fights, like those in Fantastic Lairs. I have previews for all of these. So if you go to each of these books, if you go to Ruins of the Grendel Root, you can get a free sample adventure for all of those books. Ruins of the Grendel Root has the sample adventure. Fantastic Adventures has a sample adventure. We have two sample lairs from Fantastic Lairs, all fully edited with maps and books, with all the maps and everything that you need to run them in a virtual tabletop. Descriptions of what you get. This one's Ruins of the Grendel Root, Call of Starsong Tower. It's intended to be run in 3 hours. I actually just ran this adventure recently, and it fit in 3 hours. It's a great way to teach new players how to play. I actually designed it that way. I wanted this to be a very simple, straightforward adventure that an experienced GM could run for new players and give them a real fun sense of what this hobby is all about. So I myself have embraced the idea of short form adventures, and you can pick those up in Fantastic Adventures, Ruins of the Grendel Root, Fantastic Lairs, and Fantastic Locations. So I have wonderful news. If you like short-form adventures, we are swimming in them. There are so many of them. Excellent publishers are publishing really wonderful adventures. I've really only covered just a handful of them here, but they are ones that I have personally experienced, that I've personally picked up and read, and I really love them. I don't think we have any lacking of short, really awesome short adventures for us to run our campaigns. So if you prefer running short adventures or modifying short adventures to fit into your own campaign, you could not go wrong with all of the ones that I've mentioned here today. Let's do a couple Patreon questions. Every month on the Sly Flourish Patreon, we put up a Sly Flourish Patreon Q&A. I answer every RPG related question every Friday. I get my coffee, I sit down, I love to read the new questions and answer them there. All of them go into a Patreon Q&A database that's available to patrons, so they can look up all of the different, I think we have more than 1700 Patreon questions and answers that you can search and find other people's responses, or find my responses to other people's questions on there. And some of them I talk about on shows like this, which is also linked in the RPG talk show database, so that you can see videos of me responding to questions. And some of them make their way into the very show that you're watching. Let's dive in. Arash says, I'm running an extremely modified Rise of Tiamat campaign adapted from the Wildmount continent. Currently, my 6 players are level 13 and are quite powerful. Yes, they are. Last session, my players were working with the City Watch and supposed to investigate a ship that has been illegally docking in front of an abandoned house. The PCs investigated the house before the ship arrived and found some individuals acting as lookouts. One of the PCs interrogated and roughed up one of them for info. It turns out that the operation is a bunch of pirates that are freeing some slaves in a nearby city, but there's a catch. They want the slaves to join them. I don't know how the captain should realistically react to the PCs who roughed up one of theirs and works for the City Watch, whom they despise, on top of the fact that the PCs now know about their operation. I put this in here because I think there's some really interesting bits to this. First of all, at 13th level, the characters are like superheroes in the city. It'd be like if Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman showed up. You'd know who they are. The pirate captain knows who they are. The reputation of characters, typically, I would expect this to be the case, the reputation of 13th level characters has spread almost worldwide. Right? They are up there with some of the most powerful warriors and spellcasters that the world has generally ever known. So it doesn't seem outrageous to me that the pirate captain would know them already and might also know, hey, if we try to fight them, we're just going to get killed. Right? Look what these guys have done. They've wiped out everybody. But if they could be turned to our side, they would be our weapons. So depending on what your pirate captain is like, I would play the pirate captain as saying, they roughed up some of my guys. I mean, even like they're pirates. So like, oh yeah, they blew up a house and killed half of my pirate crew. But what about the other half? And what if I could get these guys on my side? And then you could do things like, hey, our ship needs to break through an armada in order to get to the other place so we can free the slaves. But they have 12 ships and we only have the one. But we have six 13th level characters on our side. Each one of those is like four ships. They can destroy entire ships with a single spell casting of Circle of Death or Shape Water, right? They can wreck those ships. And actually, a fun way to kind of think about that is the Netflix series and the book, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, where you have sort of 1800s level battles going on. But if you can get a wizard on your side, you can completely change the course of the entire battle. When you think about 13th level characters, they bring that kind of power to a battle, to certainly an armada. So the idea that the pirate captain, even if the characters roughed up their crew, and even if they work with the town guard, if I were the pirate captain, my goal would be, I don't care what they've done. First of all, they could just kill me and kill everybody on my ship with like two spells. So me fighting them is not really that beneficial. But if I can get them on my side to do this thing for me, that is like having five or six more ships. You know, that's like having a tremendous amount of power. So bring the fact that the characters are that high level into the equation and make sure that the characters that they're interacting with, the NPCs they're interacting with, know the level of power that they're bringing and want to use that for themselves. I think that's a really powerful way to do it. Now, the other trick, though, is like level 13 characters are so powerful, they don't need to ride around on ships. They could probably teleport from place to place. They have lots of different things they can do. So the kinds of typical conventional stuff that happens for characters when they're first to fourth level are no longer problems once they get to like 13th level. And I think you want to account for that in like how their power changes the course of the game and changes the course of the story. Don't forget how powerful they are and let that power influence the story that's going on. So hopefully that gives you some ideas. Graham D says, why didn't the 4E Warlords survive into 5th edition? Too hard to design a subclass for it? A few friends and I like the mechanics and the built-in role-playing that came with the Warlord class. I'm surprised that no one has published a 5E version of it. Oh, Graham, look outside of Wizards of the Coast for your joy for 5E, because they have published the Warlord class. Level Up Advanced 5E has a Warlord class, and it's really cool. So Level Up Advanced 5E has the Marshal class. The Marshal class is your Warlord. It is built around the same ideas that the Warlord had. They felt the same way you felt, which is, hey, Warlord in 4th edition was really cool. How come we don't have one? Well, there is a Marshal class in Level Up Advanced 5E. It has all kinds of different feats, so it's not too difficult to make feats. It's not too difficult to make feats for a Warlord class. So the thing that I would do is look out beyond just what Wizards of the Coast. Embrace the material being published by other publishers, because you can find lots of different stuff that is in there. Now, my wife reminded me also that there are Bard subclasses that are very much like a Warlord. So even if you stay within 5th edition material published by Wizards of the Coast, you can still get Warlord-like stuff, but usually it's one particular subclass. But if you're really looking for a Warlord class and you want other stuff that had been kind of tossed out the window with 5th edition that were pretty good for 4th edition, I would say Level Up 5e by Eon World Publishing has lots of really cool stuff that you can pick up and run in your game. So check out the Marshal class from Level Up Advanced 5e. Again, you can pick up, if you just want to get a look at it, you can pick up the system reference document, which describes it. You can also look up directly on a5e.tools, which has descriptions, very D&D Beyond-like interface, to show you all of the stuff that the Marshal has that is similar to the 4th edition Warlord. David P. says, I find that after descriptions, my players sometimes have questions. This is great, but the problem is the questions are almost always things I said in my description, or they immediately try to do something I said wasn't possible. There's a fountain, but it's dry and not running. Can I drink some water from it? We play online, which doesn't help. I've tried to keep descriptions vivid and using at least three senses, but I'm wondering if I actually need to be less descriptive or put them on notice before giving key information. Is this even my problem, or is this something they need to change? If it's a problem, then it's kind of your problem. If you're the GM and something's not working right and you want the game to run smoothly, you know, even if it's their problem, it's also your problem. That doesn't mean they can't help you. It doesn't mean you can't have conversations with them about it. It doesn't mean that you can't fix things. But generally speaking, if you're the GM and your job is to try to make the game as fun as possible and you run into something that's a trouble, you're kind of responsible for dealing with the trouble. Is it fair? No. Should you have to? No. But the reality is that's kind of the way the situation is going to play out. Running online definitely works this way. People are distracted when they run online. They got five windows open up. They're checking all kinds of other things. Even even at the physical tables now, a lot of times people are kind of distracted by different things. That's unfortunately just kind of the way the world is these days. So one of the things you can do is just, you know, again, take whatever you're describing and focus it down as much as you can. Make sure that you're only speaking about those important points. Write them down, like get a little 3x5 note card, put down the three bullets of the main things that you want to do. By the way, you can share that note card with your players. So you can put it right on the table, or you can send out a little text with whatever text interface you're using for your online play so they can read it again if they're getting lost. That can really help. Like take, if you've got the notes about something, you want them to be clear, one of the things you can do is write them out. The other one is just describe it again. Don't worry about it. Just describe it again. It's not that big a deal. I have mentioned before that players are only grabbing about 50% of what you're throwing out there at any given time. So sometimes you just have to describe it again. I wouldn't beat yourself up about it. I wouldn't beat them up about it. Only if you're asking yourself, is this really hurting the game? Is the fact that everything is taking too long hurting the game? Or your friends just, they're having fun too. And they, so you have to describe it again. And, you know, I don't find that to be a big problem. One thing is whenever I'm switching from the perspective of one character to another, I will kind of re-describe the things that their character sees. I give them a little bit of the vision of what they notice and also what their character might notice that the player wouldn't notice. I don't expect that the player has the same level of observance that the characters do, because they don't. They're not their character. They're not actually there. They're not living in that world. And they're also not fighters and wizards and clerics, right? Right. So I think describing things like, as a cleric, you notice some religious iconography on the mural that might be more interesting to look at. Do you want to roll a religion check? I don't think that's so bad. Some people are very against that sort of leading the player on to learn things. I don't really have a problem with it. And I actually think it makes the game run smoother and is more fun. So that's definitely a way to do it. But I wouldn't beat yourself up about it. I wouldn't beat them up about it. It's a little bit of the way things go. And honestly, in online play, it's definitely more of a problem than it is an in-person play. But it's really a play in general, and people just get distracted. And particularly when we're in an environment where we don't have visuals, people are going to get even more distracted because they're looking for something for their eye to go to, which could be every other thing on the internet other than the game that you're running. So that's just that, you know, I feel like it's something that we generally have to deal with. Friends, I want to thank all of you for hanging out with me today while we talked about all things in tabletop role-playing games. I hope you enjoyed today's show. I really did. I love doing the show every week. If you like the show and you want to see more stuff like this from me, the best thing you can do is subscribe to the free Sly Flourish news. It's absolutely free to sign up. You can find a link to it in the show notes. You get a free adventure generator PDF for signing up, and you get a weekly RPG-related email, which includes links to all of the other work that I do, along with a RPG-related article of the week. You can also support me directly on Patreon. I've talked about Patreon a bunch this episode already, so I won't bring everything up again. But you get the Q&A, you get to join other fellow community of lazy DMs on the Sly Flourish Discord server. You get to support me directly with the work that I'm doing, so it really helps me out. And you get access to all kinds of outstanding products and tools and source books and things to help you run your own games. And you can pick up my books. I talked about the Fantastic Adventure books. You can pick up that Fantastic Adventure bundle. It's a really good deal. You can pick that up on Sly Flourish. You'll get access to tons of adventures and short adventures for you to run. All the links for those are in the show notes. Thank you all so much. Have a great day and get out there and play an RPG. Bye-bye.